Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discuss during the end game should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of The Endgame. Joining me, as always, from his lair in the desert, is the great and good Bill Fleckenstein. Hi, mate. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. And yourself?
Doing very well. Doing very well. I'm back in the Cayman Islands. It's hot and humid, and there's a sargassum patch the size of North America floating towards us. So the beach is littered in 3 feet of brown seaweed, which is kind of weird. Oh,
wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, anyway, if it doesn't, what doesn't reach us goes to Florida, so they can have it in Florida, as far as I'm concerned. The more of it goes up there, the better. Now, mate, we have a guest joining us today who I'm extremely delighted to be able to announce, and even more delighted to be able to get the chance to talk to, and that's Steve Iceman of the Iceman Group within Neuberger Berman, who will be known to a lot of people from his portrayal in The Big Short by Steve Carell.
Yeah, well, why don't we stop yapping and get him on?
Hey, that makes sense to me. Let's do it. Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you giving up an hour of your time on whatever the hell day is, Friday afternoon.
Friday afternoon. It's a little quiet.
Absolutely. Well, this podcast, The Endgame, we've been on this search, Bill and I, for something that we know never happens, that nothing ends, but it shifts. You know, we get these changing conditions, and we've seen so many changes in financial markets and the conditions. And, you know, it really feels more and more like we're coming to the end of something and are about to move into a completely new paradigm. So, you know, Bill and I are keen to pick your brains on what that might look like and how we move from here and how you see this playing out and what you think might be coming next.
All right, so let's just go back a little bit to set the stage. The modern version of the meaning of paradigm was created by Thomas Kuhn, who published his book in 1962, which was the year I was born. Let's not add up what the hell old that makes me.
That's right, forget it. We're all roughly around there, so let's ignore it.
It's called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And he mostly talks about physics and how you move from one paradigm to another. And there were several points in the book which were people don't give up their paradigms easily because the assumptions are so embedded in their heads. So what I like to say is you don't think about your paradigm, you inhabit it. And generally, you don't question it until the evidence is so ridiculously strong, you have to admit to yourself that you're wrong. That happens in two ways. One, generally time. And number two, once in a while, you get hit over the head with a 2x4. That's less normal. That concept of paradigm, I think, it applies very much to investing. You go through periods of styles. You know, people like to talk about market leadership. I don't think that captures it. I think it's really a paradigm. So in the 90s, when I was just starting in this business, you know, one of the major paradigms was to invest in large multinational companies like GE. That was the way to go. And people invested in them in years. And then, you know, the earnings growth wasn't so great. What happened to GE, we all know. And over time, people realized that these companies weren't coming back. So that was a time change in paradigm. The next wave of paradigm really took place between 2002 and 2008, which is let's invest in large financial companies like Goldman, Morgan Stanley, it's Bank of America, et cetera. What was the concept? You know, earnings are growing. These guys are geniuses because they're getting paid so much money and making so much money. And you know, everybody said, oh my God, these guys know how to manage risk, blah, blah, blah. And that proved to be true until 2008 because it became clear that it was not true. That's what I call getting hit over head by a 2x4. That just happened really quickly. So that ended in 08. And then the Fed really cut rates. And so then essentially what you were being paid for was to take as much risk as possible. And so the paradigm shifted to let's invest in growth stocks, largely technology companies, because they're very innovative. And within those growth companies eventually became, let's invest in the hyper growth companies that have big revenue growth and negative earnings. And what nobody seemed to understand, because it was a paradigm, was that not that these companies weren't innovative, they were, and not that they weren't great companies, they were, but the valuations of them got so high because rates were effectively zero. And that was a function of the discounting mechanism. So then you get to 2000, call it the end of 21 and then 22, Fed starts to raise rates. And all of a sudden, things seem to be shifting. You know, the people who had invested in these stocks for years and had made so much money get hit over the head by a 2x4. And it wasn't like necessarily the fundamentals had shifted so much. In some cases, they did, because you had companies who had done very well in COVID and, you know, a big pull forward in earnings. Some, it was just true that they were still good. But, you know, with rates higher, the discounting mechanism had a real effect. And so if you look, you know, all growth stocks did badly. Even NVIDIA was down 40%. But within those groups, the same companies that everybody loved, which were the hyper-growth companies, were down 75 to 90% last year. You know, when you're down 75 to 90%, you can't rest your laurels anymore on, oh, these companies are so innovative. Yeah, they're innovative, but my portfolio has been decimated.
Right.
So now that doesn't mean that, you know, certain tech companies that have real earnings won't do well in the future. You know, like an NVIDIA is very innovative. Whether it's worth the multiple that it's at, we could debate. But there isn't any question that's you know, a great company. But just to give you an idea how insane it got, you know, take two companies that I know. One's called Affirm, and the other one's called Trupanion. They have nothing to do with one another. Affirm is a buy now, pay later company, which is really a version of credit cards, but it was masquerading as a tech company. And Trupanion is a animal health insurance company that doesn't even masquerade as a tech company, because it has nothing to do with tech. It's an insurance company. The only thing these two companies have in common are that they were big revenue growth, negative earnings. And so in a year like 2021, where those stocks did very well, the correlation between those two companies, who have nothing to do with one another, was crazy high. And then in 2022, when all these stocks collapsed, again, the correlation between those two companies was very, very high. I think Trupanion was down 60% and Affirm was down 85%. Good for Trupanion. So I don't think those stocks are coming back. So where are we going? You know, the market is making this assumption that the Fed's going to eventually cut rates. I'm not a believer in that. If they do, big growth companies will have another, you know, great leg. I'm of the camp that if you take Powell at his word and rates stay higher for longer, we're going to move into a new paradigm. And what's that going to look like? It doesn't mean that people are going to abandon tech. They'll still invest in it. But I think you're going to see a lot more themes that are going to be just as important, and you're going to want a much more diversified portfolio. So what am I talking about? You're talking about, I mean, just giving an example, infrastructure. You know, two aspects to it. You've got the government spending all this money on infrastructure in the United States. And then you've got the issue of the supply chain coming home. You know, for 40 years, we had a situation where the supply chain went overseas because it was much cheaper. That was very deflationary. The problem was that during COVID, everybody realized it was, yeah, it's cheaper, but it's an incredibly brittle system, which completely broke down during COVID. So a lot of companies are bringing their supply chain closer to home. A lot of it's coming back to the United States. And that's a big theme that's going to evolve over the next several years. So like I said, I think the paradigm that we're going to go to is much more diversification. You know, I don't think for most clients, you know, we have, for example, in the Eisman Group, you know, we as a group have multi-generational clients who have very different risk profiles. And I think the other paradigm you're going to want to move to is going to be much more careful about how you're tailoring your portfolios to each individual, rather than, oh, let's put 50% of our money in tech and let it roll. Also, rates are a lot higher. Nothing wrong with investing in treasuries. Yeah. Or bonds. Part of the problem people have is that they have such huge gains embedded in their portfolios. It's not easy to sell something and pay a 35% capital gain and take that money and put it into 5% three-month treasuries. But, you know, over time, people put more money in, you know, or you sell stuff because the fundamentals are deteriorating. You'll put a portion of people's portfolios in treasuries, at this point, short-term treasuries, and some bonds. And so, like I said, you're going to have a much more diversified portfolio. I think the concept of, God forbid, risk-adjusted returns is going to come back.
Steve, let me ask you, because I think anyone that has had any kind of length of a career has been through multiple paradigm shifts, as you say, and you don't really recognize them necessarily until you look back.
Right.
But the key, I think, is recognizing that period where the paradigm is changing. That's where the money to be made. And you know, nobody more famously than you identified that paradigm shift back in 2007. And the rest of the world has the good fortune to have seen that story chronicled, both through Michael Lewis's book and obviously the movie. So how do you deal with sensing a paradigm is shifting and being able to position yourself for that paradigm shift, but stay both in the game in that period where everybody else believes you're wrong and stay sane during that time, more importantly, because that's maybe even a harder task?
So that's probably the hardest thing to do in investing. I mean, yeah. As you know, in our business, being early or too early is the equivalent of being wrong. So I think you could have a theory that things are going to change, but before you do anything significant, there has to be some kind of evidence that you're looking for that's going to show you that it's time. So, for example, if you go back to 2007, people who bet against subprime mortgages through the asset-backed world got wiped out if they did it before the end of 2006. Yep. Now, what I was always looking for was to see actual deterioration in the credit data. And that only really happened in the summer of 2006. That's when you could begin the process. You know, I think here, you know, you could have bet against a firm, for example, of Trupanion for years and gotten your head handed to you, yep, even though you were right on the fundamentals because the Fed kept rates low. That if you figured out that that was one of the major reasons why these stocks went up, you basically had to wait for the Fed to raise rates. Until then, you just wait too early. So you have to know what's the catalyst for things to change and then wait for it. That's very hard.
Yeah, it's tough. And also it's tough, as you say, to maintain conviction in your idea because you have these ideas and you see that nothing confirms that you're right in the markets. Everything keeps going against you. It's a mental trick.
And the other thing that's the problem is the people who are on the other side have been paid to be on the other side because they've made a lot of money either in the market or they're, you know, on the securitization world. They create securitization. They've made fortunes. You know, what I always like to say is, you know, if you had gone to the CEO of Lehman or any of these other firms in early 2007 and said to him, it's always him, that the entire basis of your career is wrong, is all you've done, it's not like you've improved the profitability of the company. The return on assets of the company are the same they were 10 years ago. What all you've done is leverage the balance sheet.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you have a 1% ROA, you're levered 10 to 1, the ROA is 10%. The ROAs of these companies didn't change. So if the ROA is 1% and you're levered 40 to 1, like Lehman, the ROA is 40%. So if you had said that to, you know, Dick Fuld or someone else, you don't have to just pick on him, his response would have been, that can't be right. I got paid $50 million last year. You know, people who got paid $50 million last year can't be wrong until they're wrong.
You know, Steve, when you mentioned understanding the game, or you didn't say it that way, but how the Fed impacted when it was time to do what you want to do and needing a catalyst, those kind of speak to me when I was running my short fund, which I was doing during that period. I felt like I needed to have both of those things. But I would like to know your opinion is, when you're running money on the long side, do you have to be as careful about, I need a catalyst, I need to see my theory starting to happen? Or do you feel like you can be a little more flexible because of the inherent risk-reward difference between being long and being short?
Well, the problem with being short over the last several years is it didn't work. And it didn't work because rates are zero, so any sin is forgiven. So you got to be a lot more nimble on the long-short side than you do have to be on the long-only side. I think on the long-only side, you have the luxury much more of time. That doesn't mean you can't do nothing. So, you know, I mean, we might have been overweight tech, but we weren't 1,000 basis points overweight tech or, you know, 35 points overweight tech. Some people were. You're that overweight and the environment shifts and you don't make major changes into your portfolio. I mean, look, there was some, I won't name names, but we all know them, some very, very large funds that are both run long, short and long only, who invested in some of these companies, you know, like Shopify. It's, I'm not picking on these names, but this is just what happened to them. Invested in these names for years and didn't make the change, were down 40 to 50% last year. They basically wiped out the profits of their clients for the last 8 years because, you know, the math is crushing. When you're down 50%, you got to be up 100% to be even. So imagine if you're down 50%, how much of your profits that you've made over the last 8 years or so get wiped out in 1 year? So, yes, the long-only side has the luxury of time, but if you're dramatically overweight one group, and I don't mean by like 200 basis points, I mean like by 30 basis points, not 30. Instead of being 25% invested in tech, you're 50% or 60% invested in tech, you better be a little more nimble. Now, the Eisner Group, we never did that. So we have the luxury of tinkering as opposed to making massive changes. But the people who dramatically overinvested in tech, I mean, look what happened to Cathie Woods. Like I said, the companies could be very innovative. But what most people miss, and it took me a while to understand this, was that people didn't care about valuations when rates were zero. When rates started to go up so dramatically, suddenly they care. I mean, forget about the short report on Square for a second. Here's the problem with like investing in those companies. So let's say the short report is wrong, just for the sake of argument. And it doesn't really matter in terms of what I'm saying, because the big short report that came out about a month ago only came out a month ago. So here's the issue about investing in Square when rates are zero versus rates are much higher. So when rates are zero, Square is growing and it sells 200 times earnings. And then in 2022, Square is still growing. Not as much. They had some issues in terms of accounting, but they still have good fundamentals. And the stock gets crushed. But the problem with, let's say, you know, the stock was down 60. What I can't remember what it was down last year. It went from like 200 to 70, you know, whatever that percentage is. At 70, the PE is 70 as opposed to 200. So if you like the company, and maybe you do, do you really want to invest in it in a higher rate environment when the PE is 70? Why can't it be 30? You know, there's no rhyme or reason. You know, banks, which are a much more established group, have a range of valuation. You know, when they go into recession, they go below tangible book value. As you come out of the recession, they go well over tangible book value. It's a range of valuation. With some of these companies, which are so new, there's no range of valuation. It went from insane to only partially insane.
Right.
So,
right.
Like I said, it used to sell at 200 times earnings and it sells at 70 times earnings. So is it right to invest in 70 times earnings? You know, why can't it go to 30 or 40?
You know, Steve, if we fold all of this in my head, it's just screaming Tesla, right? It's the perfect example of everything you've just talked about, because at the end of the day, it's a car company. Yes, it was sold as a software company, as an AI company, as a robo-taxi company.
Right.
The valuation got to ridiculous extremes. And now we're seeing, who would have thought that the paradigm change would
be, you know,
valuations
matter? Well, the issue with Tesla, and I have no position in Tesla, let me make clear that.
Right, right.
But the issue with Tesla, other than the multiple, and yes, you know, car companies sell at 6 times earnings and Tesla sells at, I don't know, times earnings. Let's just call it
a couple of hundred at some point.
Whatever.
Well, we need to know what their earnings really are.
Let's call it 100 just for the sake of argument. The fundamentals have shifted now. Forget about the multiple of Tesla for a second. When your sales keep going up and you're able to raise prices, that's one thing. But if you got to cut your prices 5 to 7 times to keep your sales up, that sounds like a car company to me. And I think you're beginning the shift now where people are realizing you know, it's a car company, you know, and now maybe it's a bigger growth story than other car companies, but it's a car company. People aren't buying Teslas now unless they cut the price. That's a different story.
So, Steve, when we think about these paradigm shifts, normally they take us into the wide blue yonder and we don't really understand its growth, its new
tech. By the way, let me just make one more point.
Yeah, go ahead.
During a paradigm shift, sometimes the group gets a last hurrah.
Right.
People forget this. So in 2008, just for example, obviously the financials got crushed. But in 2009, because you know the government bailed everybody out and there was massive trading profits, they had another great year. And then it was over.
Yeah.
So sometime during the paradigm shift, the old group can get one more hooray, and then we go into a new world.
Yeah. So if this paradigm shift to me feels like it could potentially be different, simply for the fact that the paradigm shift seems to be twofold. One, we're in an era of higher rates.
Right.
And two, fundamental valuations matter again. And if that is the shift, then the beauty of it is at least we have a few hundred years of history to tell us what happens when valuations matter and rates are higher. So one could argue that once you get past this period where everyone has to reallocate their portfolios, it should get a little bit easier for people if they're brave enough to accept this new paradigm.
So I agree with that. There's one issue about valuation with tech companies that we should grapple with, which is what earnings?
Right.
Yeah.
So let's see if we can pick on somebody. Okay. Let's talk about Square again. I remember again, my partners and I don't have a position in Square.
Right.
So
perfect target then.
What I'm talking about, it doesn't matter to our portfolio or to our clients. I'm just talking conceptually. So I use Bloomberg. So if you type in SQ equity EM, up will pop Square's earnings. That's adjusted earnings. So you click on this thing and it says GAAP earnings and the earnings disappear. They just evaporate. Now, why do they evaporate? Because they add back stock-based comp as if it doesn't exist. So my question to all the companies is, really, it doesn't exist? When you report your earnings to the IRS, do you deduct it from your earnings so you can pay less taxes? The answer is yes. So I will accept from any company that you should add back the stock-based comp if they act accordingly with their taxes. As long as they don't act accordingly with their taxes, it's real. So maybe one day people will do GAAP or at least subtract out the stock-based comp, which I think would be the least that they could do. Whether that's going to happen or not, I don't know. But to pick on Square again, remember, let me emphasize, I got no position in the thing. On the last conference call when they reported fourth quarter earnings, they said, you know, we're going to be much more careful with this stock-based comp because it's wrong really to add it back. And I wanted to say, really, you're the most egregious of any company to use stock-based comp. You're the sinner. So that's all I got to say on that topic.
You know, but on that and a related topic, I'd be curious to know if you have a theory about why this is the case. And what I mean is this. After going back to ancient history, 2001, you know, in the wake of all the abuse about the stock-based comp and the backdating of options and a lot of the things that went on, of course, we got SOX. It was literally never enforced in terms of, you know, if you signed the financials and they turned out to be wrong. Then we get to after 08 in the wake of that and all the bills that got passed. You were supposed to have to use GAAP numbers.
I'll tell you why this adjusted stuff has happened. Having been on the sell side, not to be overly critical on the sell side, but let's be critical. You know, the sell side just tends to accept what companies say. So if the company says, we want to show you adjusted earnings as opposed to GAAP earnings, everybody says, okay, nobody fights it. So because the sell side doesn't fight it, everybody accepts it and that this goes on. So until the SEC comes in and says, this is ridiculous and we won't allow it, it doesn't sound like they're going to do that. The only way for this to go away would be for the buy side to say enough. Whether that'll ever happen, I don't know.
When we think about paradigm shifts for investors, it feels like there's also been a paradigm shift for central banks in the last year. They've lived in this environment where they've had everything they wanted. They were able to do what they felt they needed to do with no pushback on the other side. With the arrival of meaningful inflation, have we now entered a paradigm shift for the central banks? And if so, what does that mean for their options going forward and what they're likely to do?
Well, Well, let's go back after the financial crisis, because I think this is where the intellectual mistake was made. The first time the Feds did quantitative easing, you know, a lot of economists out there said this is very inflationary.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. And why was that? Because you're in the middle of recession when this happened. Economic growth was extremely low. It made more sense for companies to buy back stock than to build new factories, for example, because that was more profitable. And so all that happened was the Fed bought a lot of bonds, which put cash on bank balance sheets. The banks couldn't lend it because nobody wanted to borrow. So they basically just gave it back to the Fed and put it back at the Fed to make a little money. So the money never really got into the economy. And that's why that QE wasn't inflationary. Now, this time around, the economy was growing. And so all this QE got into the system, combined with the fact the amount of people who moved out of the labor force was huge. And so wages had to go up to attract people. And you have an inflation period. You know, I think people like Powell and the European central banks are petrified of making the same mistake that Volcker made in the early 80s, which is Volcker raised rates. He thought he was done. I think he started to cut, and then inflation roared back, and he had to raise rates to 17%. I mean, after so many years, the idea that the Fed could raise rates to 17%, I mean, first of all, the number of people who were alive in the investment community when this happened, they're not a lot of us. I wasn't in the investment community, but at least I was alive.
Right.
So I was in college, but I remember it. So they're petrified of it, and justifiably so, which is why I think they're going to keep rates higher for longer, because I think they think the risk of inflation is the worst problem than the risk of recession.
I wanted to tie into your idea of a shifting paradigm in investing, what you've said about central banks and all this, it kind of ties in. If perhaps there are economic implications as well, like in the 30 years that ended a couple of years ago when rates had gone down for four decades and inflation was really in kind of a disinflationary place. You know, we had an economic expansion and now we're reshoring. It seems like the potential for a different kind of an economic environment than we've been in for the last three decades or so. Is that part of how you think you need to think about portfolio companies?
Well, I hear what you're saying. I think, you know, there'll be more themes, but even more importantly, the speculative environment of venture capital, I think, is probably over. And this is part, obviously, of the Silicon Valley problem, which we could talk about. But leaving that aside, you know, what's happened to venture capital in the last year or so? So as if we get back to Affirm and Trupanion as our poster boys, let's just call them. Again, I got no positions in these things, so it's all academic to me. But what's the characteristics of Affirm and Trupanion? Huge revenue growth, negative earnings. What are the characteristics of companies that venture capital buys? Huge revenue growth and negative earnings. So if Affirm and Trupanion go down 65 to 90%, venture capital companies in terms of valuation are down the same amount. So, you know, if you did round one and round two in venture capital company A when rates were zero, and now it's round three and it's the end of 2022, the value of that company is down 90%. You've basically been wiped out. Are you going to put more money in? You know, I have a friend who was in venture capital, and he told me that you know, one of the things that when he is approached for this is he says, yes, I'll put more money in if you take my money that I put in round one and round two and revalue it at the value of round three. So given what's happened to venture capital, I think my opinion, the days of people putting tons of money into venture capital in these companies, I think it's going to be very difficult.
Does that extend to private equity as well, Steve, do you think?
Not clear at this point. It depends which part of private equity you're talking about. Private equity tends not to buy companies that are venture capital-like. But what I think might make it harder for private equity is just that the cost of financing has gone up a lot. So, you know, for example, let's say, forget about office, okay, because office buildings are their own issue. But, you know, I'm here living on 79th Street in Manhattan. Let's say you bought the nice apartment building across the street. It's a nice apartment building. But you bought it in 2021 where rates are zero. Now, let's just say that the fundamentals of the building are the same. But the cap rate has gone from 3% to 7%. So the valuation is down. I mean, and your problem now is, you know, when you finance the building, you borrowed at 3%. And when your debt comes due, you're going to have to pay 7%. So what's the building worth? Well, it's not worth par, that's for sure. So if private equity is impacted, it's just going to be the stuff that you bought when financing was so low makes the valuation much harder. And going forward, you're going to have to pay less for the same thing. Now, maybe that'll happen. You'll be able to pay less, but the financing costs have gone up a lot.
Yeah, we've seen a couple of instances in big pension funds. You know, CalPERS famously sold off some of their private equity stuff at a big discount a year, 18 months or so ago. And we're starting to see more headlines like that recently of pension funds who are in this stuff. They're invested in the old paradigm.
Right.
You know, and that potentially presents another significant challenge. So how do you think, when you look at that going forward and the way that these paradigm shifts can ripple through to all kinds of unintended places, people that are invested for the long term in the old paradigm and don't really have the flexibility to shift into the new paradigm?
Well, when you're running $100 billion, I mean, if you're running $1 billion, let's just say, and you want to move things around, you can move them around. When you're running $100 billion, it's a lot harder to shift. You better start early.
Yeah. You mentioned Silicon Valley earlier on, and this Silicon Valley ecosystem obviously was kind of ground zero for this banking mini crisis that came out of nowhere for many, many people.
Yeah.
Is that a change that has significantly broader repercussions? It seems to me it does when they haven't maybe been felt yet. But what did you make of that whole episode and what does it mean for the broader markets?
So let's talk about, you know, quickly what happened to Silicon Valley and then what's happened to the rest of the banking sector, because, you know, the regional banks reported this week and it was one of the worst reporting seasons we've had in over a decade. And as a friend of mine said, we haven't even had a credit cycle yet. So let's talk about what's happened. So what happened to Silicon Valley? They had a very, very concentrated client base. It was basically a correlation of one. And they were all well above the $250,000 limit. And then, you know, because of Affirm and Trupanion, our poster children, VC couldn't raise any more money for their companies. So all those companies, which kept putting more money in the bank, Silicon Valley, as they did round one, round two, and round three, all of a sudden they can't do round four, so they have to withdraw money from the bank to fund themselves because they have negative earnings, negative cash flow. Now, Silicon Valley, unfortunately for them, I mean, their business model was actually very simple. It was mostly they took in money from venture capital and they bought securities. They didn't do that much lending. They bought a whole bunch of long-term bonds at the bottom. So their balance sheet was upside down. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's the end of the bank unless the bank has to sell. So they had to sell because their clients were withdrawing their deposits. And that was the end of Silicon Valley. You had a classic run on the bank. What's happened since then is the regional banks have lost some of their deposits from the Silicon Valley debacle. But on top of it, because rates have gone up so much. So, for example, one of the things that we're doing, some of our clients, my partners and I, we're buying 3-month treasuries for those who have some cash. You know, right now, if you want to buy a 3-month treasury, you get 5.1% as of a couple of days ago. That's a lot more than putting the money in the bank. It's even more probably than buying a 1-year CD. And if you know you put your money in a money market fund, you're making like almost 4.5%. That's like cash. Why would you buy a CD? So people are taking their money out of the banks and buying other stuff. So just to give an example, I think I read like Comerica had about $60 billion in deposits pre-COVID. It went up to something like 90, and now it's back to 60. They round tripped. So what's happened to the regional banks in this earnings season is non-interest-bearing deposits, which is obviously the best cost of funds because the rate is zero, have gone down a lot. They've had to replace that with interest-bearing deposits, and they've had to borrow from the FHLB as well. So their cost of funds have gone up a lot. So almost every single regional bank is showing net interest margin compression. They're not making earnings, and they're taking guidance down. When I look at my screen this whole week, it's like, wow, they're down again. And not down 50 basis points. They're down a lot.
Yeah.
So it's going to mean banks, without question, are going to tighten their lending standards. What we don't know yet is how much they're going to tighten their lending standards. Clearly, that's going to have a negative impact on the economy. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to go into a recession. Or if you thought it was a recession, you might think it's a severe recession. I'm an agnostic at this point about it. I just don't think there's enough data to make a decision one way or the other, because there are things on the other side, which is, you know, the consumer is still in good shape. Wages are still going up because there's still a shortage of labor. You know, what's happening in the employment market is a little bit like the revenge of the middle class in that who's getting fired? At the top end, you know, Disney's firing 10,000, Microsoft is firing, Meta is firing, Google's letting some people go, Lyft just announced it. You know, people at the upper end are getting laid off. But the numbers of those people, if you put them all together,
are not that high.
But it means the high end is having a problem. The middle and the low, they keep raising wages because they can't find people. Now, how that works into the economy overall, I mean, you could argue that, yes, you know, we're slowing down, corporations are tightening their belts, banks are tightening their belts. That's a negative, but the consumer is still okay. You know, so how do you weigh that at this point? I don't know. You know, there are people who I really respect. I mean, I'm not an economist, but people who I really respect say this guarantees a recession. And there are other people who say not sure. So we'll have to see. In 6 months, we'll know.
Yeah.
As of April, weather just changed. It's nice to go out. It's unclear.
Steve, were you surprised at the fact that all the depositors at Silicon Valley Bank over $250,000 were all bailed out? Did you have an expectation of how that would play out?
And you know, when I think about what the regulators should do and then what they do, I'm always wrong. I always think this is what they should do, so they'll do it. And they don't do it. So if I were the czar, you know, I'm not the czar. Nobody, believe me, nobody in government, hey, called up me and say, Steve, what should we do? What I would have done if I were in charge, and believe me, I'm not, was I would not have bailed out the depositors in Silicon Valley. You're big boys. You know, you're the guys who keep saying, you know, we don't want government in our business. We're capitalists. So reap what you sow. And then I would have guaranteed the deposits of everybody else. That's right. What I would have done. I think that would have been better because it would have sharply reduced the moral hazard issues.
Right. Yeah, because I didn't spend a lot of time on it because it was over so fast.
Yeah.
But I saw some credible analysis that showed that most people would have gotten 85, 90 cents. I mean, it would have hurt, but it wouldn't have been the end of the world. And as you say, you could
look, have maybe it would have been 50 cents. But okay, you put your money in the bank. What I thought was almost amusing about it was here were people who say, we're capitalists, we don't want government. And at the first sign of trouble, they come begging, you gotta bail us out, otherwise the system's gonna go down. You know what? The system wasn't gonna go down.
No, not in this case.
You could have not bailed them out and guaranteed all the other depositors. And I think you would have had the same thing happen in terms of the regional banks that you had anyway.
Yeah, the disintermediation is going to continue regardless, right?
Correct. But people would be a lot more careful
if
you hadn't bailed out the deposit in Silicon Valley. But they did, you know, so what can you do?
Steve, whenever we get these paradigm shifts we've been talking about, generally there's always some kind of trouble around an interest rate related part of the previous paradigm. You know, interest rates tend to be the cause of the money in the good times and the cause of the friction when the shifts change.
Not always.
Okay.
2007, 2008 was not an interest rate issue. It was a credit
issue. No, that's true.
No.
It was purely a credit issue. This is an interest rate issue.
Yeah.
You know, what happened to Silicon Valley, you know, as Warren Buffett likes to say, as I said many times, when the tide goes out, you find out it was naked. So you know, what happened to Silicon Valley was essentially what happened to British pension funds,
yeah,
which is everybody bought stuff at the bottom. Rates went up a lot. Somebody's going to get caught naked from it. And that was Silicon Valley.
I guess my point is that when you get these rises in interest rates, particularly at the speed we've seen, which is probably the bigger problem, it's just how fast they've gone from 0 to 5%, generally that tends to cause credit issues because you get these refinancing cycles and suddenly credit means something completely different on both sides of the board. Do you see any areas... Obviously, you saw credit problems in 2005 probably and waited till 2006 to be able to do something about it. Do you see any areas where you see the credit problems that higher rates precipitate might be, you know, the next battleground?
So I don't know how much is going to impact the economy. As far as I can tell, it's not going to be the consumer. You know, right now, delinquencies and losses are at, I don't know, 100-year lows. I mean, maybe all-time planet Earth lows. But they're low. And, you know, if we have a recession, again, I want to emphasize that the Eisen Group is not making that call at this point at all. But if we had a recession, I think the worst that would happen is you get some kind of normalization. It's not 08 when delinquencies and losses on the consumer side skyrocket. It's going to be somewhere on the non-consumer side. I think the easiest thing to say at this point is that if you had to pick a sector where it will happen, it'll be an office.
Yeah, commercial real estate. Yeah, that'd be my guess.
You know, you've got much higher rates, so the cap rates are significantly higher, the buildings are worth less, and the cash flows are lower. I believe the data is that about $175 billion of office debt has to be refinanced this year, and $150 billion has to be refinanced next year. I don't know what's going to happen. If I had to lay my life on the line, you're going to get defaults. You've already seen, by the way, Blackstone and Brookfield have already given back buildings that were considered A-quality buildings because they realize that the cash flows are much lower and they can't refinance the buildings anywhere close to where they want to. So they've given back the keys. Now, whether they've given back the keys so that they can have a nice negotiation with the bank because the bank doesn't want to operate the building, that's probably what's going on. But this, I call this like the preview of the movie.
It's like in the 80s when the SNLs would get the jingle mail. This is jingle mail on a much bigger scale.
Yes. So office is a real problem. You know, what outside of office is going to be a problem? I don't know at this point.
So Steve, without mentioning names, what areas is the Eisen Group looking at in terms of trying to understand this new paradigm and get prepared for it?
Well, we've already started. You know, my partners and I are, you know, looking for new themes, you know, new quality companies where they have very defensible business models, whether they're monopolies or duopolies or triopolies. That's what we're looking for. You know, we're looking for themes on infrastructure, which we have invested in to a degree. We're looking for other opportunities. We're even looking for opportunities of greenification, although, you know, investing in the solar companies is difficult because the valuations are nosebleed. But there'll be other ways to invest in greenification with companies that have normal valuations. You know, we're looking at bonds. We're looking at treasuries. It's just a much more diversified portfolio. We've de-emphasized very much the banks because of the obvious.
Right.
Now, you know, JP Morgan will be fine. So if I would say to someone, if you own JP Morgan, you may not make any money within the next year or so, but, you know, JP Morgan is not going away. It's probably the best run bank in the world. Over time, you make money. But, you know, as long as this net interest margin compression is going on and you haven't even had a credit cycle yet, it'll be hard to make money, but you'll certainly do much better in that than your typical regional bank.
You know, we've all been through, I don't know, 20 or 30 debt ceiling negotiations, and it's never a big deal.
Right.
This cycle looks like it could easily be more contentious. There's a few more moving pieces this time around. Do you think it will be the same business as usual, maybe with a little more speed bumps in the way? Or is there any chance something could come out of this that people haven't thought of?
If I had I mean, the usual bet is they'll make a deal at midnight on Sunday, which is when these things always tend to happen.
Right.
Because this way, both sides save face. I do think that there's a possibility that nothing happens at midnight on Sunday, because on the Republican side, you know, the Speaker is the weakest that we've probably ever had, because he is hostage to 5 or 6 congresspeople who are extremely right-wing. So I certainly think the odds of going over the deadline are not insignificant. It's going to be more interesting to see what happens after the deadline. So I don't know if you remember when Clinton and Gingrich went toe-to-toe, we did go over the deadline. And then what happened was people didn't get their Social Security checks, Medicare stopped, Medicaid stopped. People got hysterical, started calling Congress and said, what are you doing to me? And, you know, Gingrich backed down and they raised the debt ceiling. If I had to lay odds, I think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at 1 month or 3 month money, it's telling you that there's at least an elevated possibility of you being right there.
I don't think that's true. I think that the 1 month, you know, it's just the yield curve. I actually don't think the market thinks it's even possible that we're going over the deadline.
All right. That's fair enough. So, Steve, you said something there, just, I know we'll wrap it up in a second, but you said something there that kind of stuck in my head. When you talked about JP Morgan, you said, you'll make money over time because it's JP Morgan, it's a great company. That feels like another paradigm shift, this idea that, you know, everybody's got accustomed to, I want to make money today, this month, this week, this year. I'm not prepared to be patient anymore. Is that another paradigm shift, the return to patient investing, do you think?
I do. Let's go to Amazon. Amazon's obviously one of the greatest companies in the history of the world. But because of what happened to Amazon, everybody's looking for the next Amazon.
Right.
And people don't remember, it took a long time for Amazon to become Amazon. You know, it's not like at the beginning of Amazon, Bezos was packaging books on his knees outside his garage. It took years for it to become Amazon. You know, and obviously people who invested in it early made fortunes, but it didn't happen in one day. But because of that, everybody's always looking for the next Amazon and they want it to happen in a week. But given how much those stocks went down last year, I think people are going to have to develop patience over time. But, you know, it's not easy for people to change their mindsets. The analogy I always like to use is that when Moses took the Israelites out of Egypt because of the golden calf, God decreed that the first generation of Israelites were not worthy of entering the promised land. So Moses marched them around for 40 years around the desert till the entire first generation died. And then the second generation was allowed to go into the promised land. And if you remember your Bible, Moses wasn't even allowed to go into the promised land. Now, do I think we need 40 years to get people to change their minds? I certainly pray not. But it might take another year or two. That's certainly possible.
Yeah, evidently so. Steve, look, we're right up against the hour. It's been absolutely fantastic. I'm so appreciative of you for taking this time to talk to Bill and I. I've enjoyed every minute of it. So thank you very, very much for agreeing to do this with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Maybe we can do it again sometime.
I would love that. Thanks so much, Steve.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
That was awesome. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it was a slightly different angle of things. But I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that we're not in the period that we were in before. And whether you want to talk about paradigm shift or how you want to speak about it, there are some facts that powered markets and economies for 2, 3, 4 decades that simply are not operable anymore. You know, whether you want to talk about the onshoring, offshoring, the secular decline in inflation, the secular decline in rates and all that, we're in a different environment prospectively.
Well, I'd come at that from the other way, Bill, and I'd say, tell me one thing that is the same. Now, because if you think through it all the things that matter, whether it is at the very bottom, the cost of money, or it's timelines, or it's valuations, or it's real estate, or it's tech.
We can't define what a man or a woman is anymore.
Right. There we go. exactly right. I mean, everything has changed. And that to me is the very epitome of a paradigm shift. And it's funny to watch people thrashing around trying to figure out, well, this must just be by the dip still.
Wouldn't you think that what you're also saying is the level of uncertainty has increased? Like, for instance, Steve doesn't have a strong opinion about where we are exactly in the economy. I certainly understand how you can have that viewpoint, because if you're open-minded, even though it looks like a slam dunk, we're headed to recession, it just won't quite get rolling. There's a lot more uncertainty, it seems to me. And one would think that would lead to lower valuations. Of course, the one thing that we didn't talk about to him, and one thing that has warped everything and makes it hard to analyze, is the fact the market's not the market, thanks to what our friend Mike Green has made us all aware of. So I think that the trying to sort out how the economies and the market will play out is extremely more difficult now than it was post the stock bubble or the real estate bubble. And so now we're in the wake on the downside of the everything bubble, so to speak. I think it's much trickier right now. It might get clear in 2 days or 2 months, or might not.
But, and again, I think the nature of that thrashing around while people kind of rage against the dying of the light is so volatile and so violent that assuming the paradigm has shifted and settling in for the long run, you can be whipsawed massively in the short term and get kicked out of these trades. You know, this idea of patient investing, which is why it's, to me, it's so important that, as Steve said, you can get almost 5% in 3 months' money. Happy days. You know, I'm very happy to take that and sit out and wait and see what the next 3 months brings, get through the debt ceiling, see if financial gravity reasserts itself, and then take a fresh look at the landscape.
Yeah, when you say it that way, I think one would have expected equities to have been weaker.
You would think, right?
But again, if I take how I look at the market now because of what I've learned from Mike, and then you add in something from what Jim Cressant has had to say about, you know, the structured products and how the whole derivatives book, you know, has become such a speculative plaything, but how they feed together, it sort of makes the market like, okay, it's bulletproof. Oh my God, then it collapses. It's just,
yeah.
I think you have to be more open-minded to outcomes, even if they might only be temporary, than at any time since I've been in the investment business, which is, you know.
Yeah. I mean, look, the market's still got its Kevlar vest on, but sooner or later, someone's going to get off a headshot. I mean, that's the kind of the way to think about it, right? And the bulletproof vest ain't
going to matter anymore. SIVP should have been a sobering wake-up call, but, you know, they bailed out the people, even the ones that deserved to take a hit and could have afforded to.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, no, if you... exactly right. Yeah, so anyway, but...
Well, we have another big paradigm shift in the change of... what should we call it? Under new management sign being hung outside the Bank of Japan this last month.
Yes. So we're going to have to see if something new and interesting, exciting happens. So we'll have to find a guest that'll want to talk about that.
I think you and I both know that James Aitken is the man for that job. So we'll have to pin James down and get him to come and talk about that. Well, listen, mate, that was as always incredibly enjoyable. So much fun. Our thanks to our guest Steve Eisman of the Eisman Group within Neuberger Berman. I don't think Steve's on social media. I'm pretty sure he isn't. But for those of you that want to look him up, you'll find him at Neuberger Berman within the Eisman Group. We will be back again with another Endgame in the not too distant future, hopefully with the Lord of the Dark Matter himself to talk all things BOJ. But if we can't talk to James, we'll find someone else to talk about. In the meantime, thanks to you for listening. If you want to follow us on Twitter and you don't already, you'll find me at TTMYGH.
And where am I, mate?
As far as I know, you are the one and only at Fleck Cap.
Still
always
there.
Always have been, always will be.
I had a really serious imposter recently. Oh my God, did he do a great job. Oh my God, yes. I couldn't even type out his variation of my handle because my keyboard wouldn't make the right... Anyway.
He kind of had the same hair, though. There's no way.
He just stole all my stuff. Anyway.
Damn it. All right, listen, so for anyone out there, only accept the original. There's only one, the original and the best.
There you
go. Fleck Cap.
Okay.
All right, mate, I'll talk to you soon.
Great.
Nothing we discussed during the Endgame should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.